Their Kingdom Come. Now, on A View from the Bunker. The greatest threat to Christianity in America today may well be the pastor standing at the pulpit. Now, not all pastors, maybe not even most of them, but certainly some of the most influential and well-known in the United States. And this is a warning that's been sounded by our guests tonight for quite some time. And in contacting them to set up this interview, I expressed the sense that I owed them an apology because I didn't really grasp the significance, I think, of what they've been writing about and talking about for the last several years until just the last 4 to 6 weeks. They are the authors of The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, author and editor of The Hidden Face of Terrorism, and numerous articles collected at the Conspiracy Archive. And, of course, we'll put a link to that in the show notes at PIDradio.com. We welcome back to The Bunker Paul and Philip Collins. Guys, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks for having us, Derek.
The last couple of months, for some reason, I think it was the Governor Mark Sanford affair and his reference to C Street, which is a building in Washington, D.C., owned and operated by the Washington Fellowship or the International Fellowship or the Family. They go under several different names for tax purposes, apparently, that brought this topic back to my attention. And then through the course of interviewing Jeff Charlotte, the author of The Family, a book about this group, and Constance Cumby, who's been warning about the convergence of the New Age movement and evangelical Christianity for quite some time now, I began to grasp that you guys have been writing and talking about this all along. And you linked, thankfully, this particular article, Their Kingdom Come, the title, Dominionism's Quest for Political Capital in the Emergent World Order, in the show notes to the Jeff Charlotte interview. And in going back and rereading this, again, I began to grasp the nature of the threat posed by this dominionist heresy. In short, it seems to me that the flock had better start looking around because quite a few of the sheep have suspiciously long and pointy teeth. Am I overreacting or getting paranoid here?
No, absolutely not. And you shouldn't feel too bad about the the time that it took to reach an epiphany. One of the things that I came to the realization of way back in about 93, 94, you know, when I was 17, 18 years old, first, you know, engaging in this research, is that you have to allow people to wake up to what's going on at their own pace. It might take a person a span of days. It might take them a span of years. But you know, they have to be allowed to go at their own pace, because you know, too much too soon might just be too traumatic for them. And that's just how the human mind works. That's how we're psychologically wired. To basically allow a little bit in portion by portion, you know, because too much at once can actually be too great of a shock to the system.
Cognitive dissonance burns.
Yeah, exactly. I think of the beginning of H.P. Lovecraft's story over Cthulhu. You know, where he says that
he says I love it. It's one of my favorite portions of his writing. His occultism aside, the man obviously was a gifted writer.
Yes,
he said that he believed that the greatest gift to man was the inability of the human mind to correlate all of its contents, because should the contents be successfully correlated and an overall informational gestalt become transparent, then man would go insane.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we first really started to stumble across this, I'd say back around late 2006 to 2007, Michael Corbin, who we were working with at the time, who was a radio talk show host out in Denver, Colorado, mm-hmm. he wanted us to look into the Ted Haggard affair. the Ted Haggard scandal, mm-hmm. and see what we could find. And we found out that he was a participant in this group known as the Council for National Policy. And the Council for National Policy was made up of a lot of Dominionist thinkers, Marvin Alasky, D. James Kennedy, mm-hmm. One of the founding members, Reverend R. J. Rushdoony was a Dominionist thinker, and we decided to explore Dominionism a little bit deeper, because it was motivating a group that was acting contradictory to the tenets of Christianity, and yet it claimed to be this kind of Christian conservative traditionalist group, you know. So it made us wonder about, you know, about the philosophy that was, you know, motivating its actions, or the actions of its individual members. And so that's what led to us, you know, basically exploring Dominionism, and it took us in some very interesting directions, to say the least.
Well, now, as some background for listeners who maybe have heard the term but don't really understand, what is Dominionism?
Well, Derek, Dominionism, and by the way, the term was actually coined by a sociologist, and sociology coming out of the Comtean positivist heritage that it comes from should already prompt enough suspicion as is. That being said, though, the sociologist's the identification of Dominionism as a distinct threat to democratic governance and an overall threat to the individual liberties of people is not incorrect. But in essence, what Dominionist theology holds, being premised on post-millennial theology, is that Jesus is either unwilling to or incapable of returning to earth until the Dominionists actively work to establish his kingdom here. And this is in contradistinction to the traditional view that Christ would return of his own accord, and that no actions by man would facilitate that parousia. Basically, though, if you look at Dominionism, it is really, and this is from a philosophical vantage point, and from a study of its theology, it is a cult of neo-Gnostic jihadists committed to goals that almost mirror the objectives of earlier socio-political utopians, typified by Comtean positivist, progressives, Marxism, communism, fascism, national socialism. And this is indeed ironic, because progressivism, Marxism, Comtean positivism, all those are considered animals of the left, and the political left is right now one of the largest, one of the loudest megaphones identifying Dominionism as a threat. And mm-hmm. The irony is that their theology and their beliefs actually originated with the political left. Now, ironically, all modern sociopolitical utopianism originated with the overtly anti-Christian Enlightenment, and in turn, the Enlightenment represented the codification of Gnosticism as revolutionary doctrine. Gnosticism taught that in the beginning there was a spiritual singularity. This pure unity was divided into a plurality by Jehovah, who was blasphemously caricatured by the Gnostics as the Archon of Arrogance. And this pre-cosmic splintering of the singularity resulted in the creation of the universe, which was governed by the demonic agents of time and space. And humanity was thrust into this cosmic prison, fettered by the physical laws of nature, by moral absolutes typified by the Mosaic Law, Jehovah's Ten Commandments, and separated from the divine pneuma of the beyond. The pneuma of man found itself trapped in a perpetual state of alienation, and this state could only be overcome through action based on gnosis, that is, the revelatory knowledge of humanity's unity with the divine. Now, the Gnostic conception of unity with God should not be confused with the traditional Christian conception as it was distilled in 2 Peter 1:4, where Peter talks about Christians being partakers of the divine nature. That is what's known as theosis, mm-hmm. or being conformed to the image of the resurrected Christ. In contradistinction, Gnosticism actually taught that man was part and parcel of God. As such, man was God. Thus, the promise of Gnosis was the promise of the transfiguration of human into divine, or apotheosis. Mm-hmm, in the original Greek, the prefix apo means from, which indicates a distinction, a separation. And of course, theos means God. So apotheosis connotes a transfiguration that takes place completely apart from God. And salvation for the Gnostic was not redemption through Jesus Christ from sin, but was redemption from the stupefaction of his isolation and alienation within the material cosmos through Gnosis. And Gnosticism divorced the Creator from this salvational process, thereby opposing Christians' theocentric soteriology with an anthropocentric soteriology. No longer was this a salvation through divine intervention, through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on Calvary, but it was a self-salvation, a doctrine of self-salvation. Now, during the Enlightenment, religious Gnosticism became political Gnosticism. The Gnostic trappings of early socio-political utopian movements is demonstrable in the various ideas that were promoted by luminaries. For instance, Condorcet promoted a doctrine of a coming utopia where indefinite progress would eventually lead to a natural salvation of immortality, of plenty, of abundance. And this doctrine of natural salvation merely reiterated the Gnostic doctrine of self-salvation. Another case in point was the Enlightenment luminary Voltaire, who wrote the story Plato's Dream. And in Plato's Dream, he basically distorts Plato's dualism, Plato's conception of reality as being divided into the being and the becoming. And basically portrays all of the physical cosmos as a prison into which man has been unjustly thrust by a demiurge, and he
that
is
being
thus,
Jehovah, right?
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And he is thus excused completely from any adherence to moral absolutes, from any moral compunction, and he is basically free to do what he will because his condition, being here in the ontological confines of this physical universe, is purely an accident, and rendering him completely and totally unaccountable to any moral master. You'll notice that the narrative is very, very dependent upon the eschewal of the doctrine of original sin, which is what binds man to accountability to God. And this is a mainstay of Gnosticism, was the complete and total eschewal of original sin.
You can see why St. John referred to it he didn't even refer to it as a spirit as the Antichrist. He referred to Gnosticism as the spirit of Antichrist. It's our conviction that everything antichristic comes out, basically finds its origins in Gnosticism, and that Gnosticism was the original lie spoken in the garden. Absolutely.
Right.
Another trapping of the Enlightenment that could be considered an outgrowth of Gnosticism was an overall veneration for the serpent in the garden, which of course Jesus identifies in the Book of Revelation as the devil himself.
Mm-hmm.
In the hypostasis of the Archons, an ancient Egyptian Gnostic text, Jehovah of course is caricatured as the Archon of arrogance who fettered man with superstition, and simultaneously the serpent is portrayed as humanity's benevolent instructor and an incognito savior. And this Gnostic veneration of the serpent, who Christians recognize as the devil, was very much a trapping of the Enlightenment, as was evidenced by the book Encyclopedia, which was edited by Denis Diderot. The book actually featured a picture of Lucifer, and Lucifer was standing beside the Masonic symbols of the square and compass. And it's interesting to note that Diderot, who was ostensibly an atheist, would select religious personages such as Lucifer to adorn his compendium of human knowledge. Diderot's appropriation of the symbol of light and rebellion, which was Lucifer, as a core icon for the title page of Encyclopedia, suggests a conception of human knowledge that parallels the fallen angels' hubristic belief that he would make himself like the Most High.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's known as Luciferianism. It's basically the belief that man shall facilitate his own salvation through his own cognitive powers, which were symbolically, allegorically represented through Lucifer. They do not subscribe to the belief in a literal metaphysical entity known as Lucifer. Instead, they only subscribe to the belief in Lucifer as an allegorical model upon which man should be patterned. And Luciferianism was disseminated on the popular level as secular humanism. And I think that Whitaker Chambers, who was a former member of the communist underground in the United States, provided the most eloquent summation of secular humanism when he said, and I'll quote him verbatim for the audience, "Humanism is not new. It is, in fact, man's second oldest faith. Its promise was whispered in the first days of creation under the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Ye shall be as gods," unquote. But this all, of course, was a codification. The Enlightenment was a codification of an ancient Christian heresy. And the codification of that ancient Christian heresy, being Gnosticism, resulted in the secularization of the very Christian eschatology that Enlightenment theoreticians and activists detested. This secular eschatology, which assumed a myriad of forms among modern socialist revolutionary movements, proffered a redemptive world history that culminated with an immanent parousia facilitated by the hand of man. For instance, Marxism held that the proletariat would redeem the world from thousands of years of class exploitation. Likewise, Hitler's Arianism,
mm-hmm,
promised to redeem the world from the alleged corruption of mankind by so-called inferior races. While these two ideological camps superficially feuded with one another, these two movements shared a crucial dialectical commonality, and that was a redemptive interpretation of world history. And herein was an anthropocentric soteriology, which mandated the establishment of an earthly paradise for the sociopolitical utopians who hearkened from the Enlightenment tradition. Salvation was not attained through saving knowledge in Jesus Christ, but through
gnosis and acting upon gnosis, which would essentially result in the resculpting of the material conditions of existence itself, and
okay,
basically
now,
the transformation of the transformation of Earth into Eden, and this is what Eric Voeglin in his book The New Science of Politics referred to as amanitizing the eschaton,
mm-hmm.
which basically means that the eschaton, that is the end of days. Is reconceptualized as an object of immanent experience. Immanent comes from the term immanence, which comes from the Latin phrase in manere, which means to remain within. Objects of immanent experience remain within the ontological confines of the physical universe. Likewise, the eschaton envisioned by these socio-political utopians was remained within the ontological plane of the physical universe. It indwelled the material cosmos. And this is where we see the rise of a new variety of Gnostic, the immanentist Gnostic, the secular Gnostic, or the neo-Gnostic. In contradistinction to the traditional Gnostics, the traditional Gnostics bestowed metaphysical primacy upon the transcendent and absolutely derided the physical cosmos. On the other hand, the neo-Gnostics basically transplanted the notion of gnosis, the concept of gnosis, within the ontological confines of the physical universe, reconceptualized it as a secret knowledge on how to manipulate the forces of nature for a socio-political agenda. And out of this would come a myriad of secular neo-Gnostic enclaves such as communism, fascism, all of which sociologically they were ostensibly secular movements, but sociologically they behaved like religions.
Well, yeah, now, and not to interrupt the flow of what
sure.
because you're outlining this in a very linear fashion, which I really appreciate and I think is really important
sure.
to cover the background. But just to recap, basically you're describing now a belief system that culminates in a political movement to try to instigate the end of days.
Right.
For
exactly.
the purpose of creating a literal heaven on earth. And it's very
absolutely
okay. And it's very easy to see in the writings of New Agers, which are freely available all over the internet, from Barbara Marx Hubbard, David Spangler, the Lucis Trust, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. You see that all throughout their writings. That is
right.
what they're all about. And in the interview that did with Constance Cumby recently, she made it very clear, and in fact it was spelled out very clearly in her book The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow 25 almost 30 years ago, the very clear influence of this kind of Gnostic belief in the occult underpinnings of the Nazis.
With the Nazis especially too, the Gnostic trappings that it no doubt inherited from its socio-political utopian origins with the Enlightenment, and those socio-political utopian origins are definitely there, although there's some rejection of traditional Enlightenment ideas amongst the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
The Gnostic trappings become very evident with for instance Hitler's Arianism, which of course I mentioned earlier.
Sure.
This notion of humanity experiencing a diaspora from a racial unity, a mm-hmm. one root race, into several competing races. And then you have a redemptive interpretation of history there, where the mission of the Nazis was to eradicate the inferior races and return humanity to the purity of its racial singularity.
Mm-hmm.
That stems from the monism of Gnosticism. You also have the notion of an eschaton that indwells history itself, as is evidenced with the Third Reich. the Gnostic trappings are very much there, and with its ideological kissing cousin, communism. I mentioned earlier that a core feature of Gnosticism was the theme of alienation, man being sequestered within the physical cosmos, perpetually alienated and alienated from the Creator. Well, alienation was a theme with which Marx was very familiar, mm-hmm. and he propagated it quite a great deal. While the alienation of the proletariat certainly was a legitimate grievance, I might add that Marx's institution of socialism and redistribution of wealth certainly did not promise to mitigate problem of alienation.
No.
But that Gnostic theme of alienation is very much prevalent there within Marxism and the myriad of forms of socialist revolutionary movements that would come out of Marxism.
Now let's transform this, or take this background and apply it to the threat posed to evangelical Christianity.
Absolutely.
Because the people that you mentioned, whose names you mentioned, guys like Ted Haggard, while in disgrace now, was formerly the president of the National Association of Evangelicals. D. James Kennedy, recently deceased, but also a very prominent and influential Christian leader who was very politically active. And there are a number of very politically active people who kind of fall under this umbrella of Dominionist thought, up to and including guys like Doug Coe and his predecessor in the family, Abraham Verrede.
Right.
Who ostensibly, at least externally, say the right things about salvation coming through Jesus Christ alone.
Exactly.
Which would seem to contradict the teachings of the Gnostics. So
you're on the right track. The entire key to understanding Dominionism's place in this history of ideas,
mm-hmm.
is in understanding its soteriological assumptions. Again, like you said, these men espouse faith in Jesus Christ, espouse faith in Jesus for salvation. However, their soteriology is no less anthropocentric than the soteriology of the socio-political utopian movements that preceded them.
In other words, God needs us to enact his policies.
Exactly. The problem begins with the Dominionist mandate to facilitate the coming of the kingdom. As you know, in the book of Hebrews, it says that the second coming of Christ, the parousia, is the final installment of our salvation. It basically says that Christ will appear a second time unto salvation. That's what is said in Hebrews. However, when it becomes the duty and mission of man to facilitate that second appearance, no longer is salvation now the responsibility of God, but salvation becomes the responsibility of man. And herein is the anthropocentric soteriology that we saw with Gnosticism, that we saw with the myriad of socio-political utopian movements, and this core doctrine, this belief in self-salvation, which is really almost no different from the natural salvation proffered by anti-Christian thinkers such as Condorcet of the Enlightenment ilk.
And it leads to this kind of fixation with this worldly plane.
Absolutely.
I mean, you bring up D. James Kennedy, Derek. I personally don't believe that he was consciously, involved in the subversion of Christianity. I think he had been unwittingly indoctrinated into Dominionism. He certainly didn't seem to see himself as involved in a social engineering project. That's not the way he viewed himself. But he was unwittingly brought into the Dominionist fold, believing that it was in fact primordial Christianity, primitive Christianity. And if you'll notice, if you go back and you watch some of the episodes of the show that they that his church had, the Coral Ridge Hour. It's over time, each sermon became less of a sermon and became more of a political speech.
Right.
And you could see this growing fixation with this worldly plane,
right,
with the man. And that's that neo-Gnosticism at work in the man's thinking. The whole entire time, he believed himself to be a blood-bought saint of Jesus Christ.
Right.
Well, and that's the danger for a lot of the people sitting in the pews. I was on the mailing list for D. James Kennedy's political action, I don't know if you want to call it Political Action Committee, but it was his Center for Reclaiming America.
Right.
And it appeared that he, like many well-meaning Christians, believed that they were doing the Lord's work by being active in politics, by seeking political solutions to the problems that face us. And as many Christians, conservative Christians particularly, are among the most patriotic of Americans.
Yes, yes.
That is a very easy sale to make.
Not only that, Derek, but he also was coming to the minds that non-active Christians were actually sinning. That it was a sin not to be politically active.
Well, and there are those prominent evangelicals who took it even a step further. In an interview last year with John Ankerberg, the very prominent radio host Janet Parshall flat out said that voting for a third party candidate was antithetical to the Word of God.
Right, right, right. So you can see where we're starting to roll down a slippery slope off into the realm of revolutionary.
Right.
There's obviously a difference between using the scriptures as a barometer for making decisions within the political process. Jesus never divorced himself when he was here in his first coming as both man and God. He never divorced himself entirely from the system. He believed that you should render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he gave his disciples the means and the methods by which society could be changed. However, those means and methods were completely and totally apolitical. Today, there's no inherent sin in basically taking part in the political process. I would by no means endorse abdication theology, which some people have fallen into.
So that would be the opposite end of the spectrum, just exactly. avoiding politics altogether.
The other dialectical extreme. The problem is when politics assumes a salvational character for the believer, because you will not be saved by government. You will not be saved through politics, and in so believing that, and I know many evangelicals who fall into that trap. You are either wittingly or unwittingly falling into the anthropocentric soteriology of earlier sociopolitical utopian movements, such as communism, such as fascism, and such as dominionism. The irony is that dominionism is you know most often identified as the enemy by the political left. Rachel Maddow, Chris Hitchens. The blowhard Olbermann, Michelle Goldberg, and correctly so, they correctly identify dominionism as a distinct threat to democratic governance and as a theocracy in embryo. However, what they fail to mention is that they subscribe to an anthropocentric soteriology that is no different from dominionism. Mm-hmm. And this is where we see the transformation of the culture war into an enormous Hegelian dialectic. The core commonality is this anthropocentric soteriology, the belief that the eschaton indwells history and that through the efforts of man it can be drawn into the ontological confines of the physical universe. Thus, with groups such as the family,
in the family, you have several evangelicals and several conservatives or ostensibly conservative traditionalist individuals who espouse anti-globalist beliefs. They oppose the ideas of global governance, of world governance, of basically the sacrificing of national sovereignty and the subordination of nation states to a supranational entity. However, what do they pose as a viable alternative? They pose the idea of Pax Americana, empire. Well, essentially, when you strip away all the superficial appellations, empire really only qualifies as unilaterally initiated world government. Because, after all, in an empire, all nation states, again, are subordinated to a supranational entity, which is instantiated under the appellation of empire. However, for them, it really makes no difference. It's really obviously something entirely different, and that's the danger of the dialectical thinking that has come to pervade the culture war. Mark Ambender, who wrote about the CMP, which is another dominionist machination, he characterized it as the conservative answer to the Council on Foreign Relations.
Mm-hmm.
but the problem is that while the CMP, like the family, espouses these anti-globalist these anti-globalist propensities, the CMP no less pursues the goals of empire. It's closely aligned with several neoconservatives, who, by the way, neoconservatives hearken from that Enlightenment tradition.
Sure, they started out as Trotskyites.
Yeah,
yes, they did. That's correct. And they kind of were brought into the fold by the old line establishment because the old line establishment believed that they could provide a legitimate competing philosophy, a competitor to the communist threat coming from the East. And then when they got into the establishment, they basically went on a rogue trajectory, and caused a fracturing in the establishment.
What's especially interesting about dominionists' close alignment with neoconservatives is their defense of the doctrine of preemptive warfare, preventative warfare. Ted Haggard, who Paul mentioned earlier, believed that spiritual warfare found a tangible worldly correlative with preemptive warfare or preventative warfare. And there again you see this neo-Gnostic reconceptualization of a transcendent article of faith as an object of emanate experience. He completely and totally transplants the notion of spiritual warfare here within the ontological confines of the physical universe within the institution of preemptive or preventative war. What's especially interesting about that is preventative warfare or preemptive warfare, those ideas rode into vogue astride the era of social Darwinism and eugenics. So, while you know many a dominionist, many of these post-millennial evangelicals ostensibly oppose Darwinism and ostensibly oppose evolutionary theory, they are in fact embracing Darwinism in principle. And really, that anybody who reads the autobiography of Darwin by Desmond and Moore will discover that Darwin formulated all of his scientific theory after he had basically adopted his worldview, which involved competition, free trade, imperialism, racial extermination, sexual inequality. So, in essence, Darwin's worldview
was formulated before his scientific theory was, and he was, for all practical purposes, formulating his scientific theory so as to affirm that worldview. So, in truth, Darwinian biology is inconsequential. Biology really has very little to do with it. What is really in question were the principles that Darwin was attempting to find a scientific rationale for. So if you reject Darwinian biology, but you embrace Darwinian principles, how are you any less a Darwinian? Mm-hmm. And in this sense, Dominionists, through their advocacy of preemptive or preventative warfare, are really just Darwinians, just a Darwinian of another stripe. They eschew Darwinian biology, but they embrace Darwinian principles.
This is a belief system that manifests itself in a number of different ways throughout what passes for evangelical or fundamental Christianity. On the left, you've got the emerging church movement, which is eschewing doctrine in favor of experiential religion. What God told us through His Word is not as important as what I feel.
Right, exactly.
And then on the far right, if you want to use the old labels of left and right, you've got the Joel's Army crowd, which is using military terms to describe this coming conflict, and actually going so far as to prophesy that these things will necessarily come to a military conflict.
Yeah, basically taking what William Branham said and kind of sticking it on its head.
Right.
Even though. Branham, still, I gotta say, with or without Joel's Army, Branham's beliefs were kind of questionable. You know, it's basically our belief that you know, he was called to a healing ministry, but he was never called to theology or to a ministry.
Yeah, well, in almost a neo-Gnostic fashion, he biologicized the entire doctrine of salvation, because he completely and totally couched the salvation of the individual in genetics with his whole doctrine of serpent seed.
Yeah, which was scary also, because it basically, you know, you follow the rationale there. There's a whole group of people that actually are genetically related to the serpent,
right,
you know, which and how's that any different from what white supremacist
Christianarianism,
what they believe about basically Eve having had sex with the serpent, mm-hmm. and that leading to the creation of the Jewish people, and you know, on and on it goes.
For the average Christian in the pew, it's pretty easy to look at the Gnostics, the New Age movement, and see the enemy. Okay, it's
right.
Easy to recognize that enemy. The difficulty, I believe, is in looking at people like Doug Coe. At, you know, hey, these guys are responsible for the National Prayer Breakfast, which just took place within recent weeks, by the way. And how can that be a bad thing? Or taking it a step further, those who are responsible for organizations like, Lou Engel and The Call, for example, which again is a Joel's Army type movement to militarize tens of thousands of young Christians, nominal Christians in the United States, for prayer, to become prayer warriors, to try to bring about this conflict against the forces of evil and the forces of darkness. Even more subtle, the whole Left Behind movement. I see that they're getting ready to release a couple more games in the Left Behind series. And
it's interesting you bring that one up. We can go into Left Behind in our new article.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, we basically talk about the fact that Edward Teller was a participant in the CMP, and of course he's considered the father of the H-bomb and was a member of the Manhattan Project.
But, right. Yeah.
Well, what many people don't understand is that he was also a devotee of the cult of the superweapon.
Yes, the cult of the superweapon, by the way.
It's not an informal group.
No. This term was coined by a literary critic named H. Bruce Franklin in his book, War Stars. And in that book, he discusses the American imagination's fascination and preoccupation with the concept of a super weapon that would bring an end to all wars.
Yeah, it was a radical utopian vision that said that you need to contended that you need a super weapon, something that could bring about extinction, to scare the world into world peace, and then the world would basically be ruled by a worldwide dictatorship that had a monopoly over lethal force, which basically had the possession of this nuclear of this super weapon to compel everybody to be nice with one another.
I'm laughing because this sounds a lot like Dr. Strangelove.
Dr. Strangelove is the embodiment of the cult of the super weapon, because basically who Kubrick was working at representing through Strangelove. Strangelove was supposed to be basically a composite of Edward Teller, of Herman Kahn, of all the
Megadeth intellectuals.
Yeah,
really.
All these. Yeah, that's what he was working towards.
But before we proceed any further, let me throw out a little disclaimer. When you hear the term cult, the phrase "cult of the superweapon," what it's meant to connote here is not any sort of formalized institution or coherent organization. What it instead connotes is a faddish obsession with an idea, a principle, a notion. And in the case of the cult of the superweapon, the faddish obsession was with the concept of the superweapon being imbued with almost a quasi-divinity as the means by which world peace could be achieved and utopia could be established.
And the weapon has evolved over time. It kind of started off as biological in science fiction literature, because that's basically where it got its start, was in early science fiction literature with H.G. Wells' Moving Forward.
Right.
And it started off as biological, it became nuclear, and now it's becoming a kind of extraterrestrial nature, a kind of a space weapon.
Right.
Not to divert too far here, but that's an interesting thread I want to tie in here as we record this on Saturday, October 17th of 2009. I just got done watching a couple hours on the History Channel on Atlantis and the search for it, the mythical land from whence the master race descends, and UFOs. So, interesting. They're just continue salting those memes in there. Anyway.
No. Oh, yeah. The cult of the superweapon, out of it would emerge the whole UFO culture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because basically what the UFO community believes by and large is that with the birth of the nuclear age, Earth was introduced into
the exploding of the nuclear bomb basically facilitated man's introduction into the intergalactic community, because
it alerted the different extraterrestrial races to our presence and caused them to start visiting in earnest here on Earth.
And here you have the emergence of an exotheology, which again is neo-Gnostic in character, because they basically portray those extraterrestrials as God. Basically the progenitors of the human race through panspermia. Mm-hmm. And of course, if they are God, and they being purely immanent entities are completely and totally bereft of the transcendent qualities that are intrinsic to God, then God indwells the physical cosmos. And again, this is neo-Gnosticism. This is Immanentist Gnosticism. It's very much closely aligned with the monism of the New Age, the belief that God indwells all things.
Yeah, this is really getting into a discussion of what's going into our new book, Invoking the Beyond. And all, because it all ties together. But you know, Edward Teller was a participant in the CMP, and if you look at the CMP, it's really dominionist devotees to the cult of the superweapon, beginning with the CMP's founder, Tim LaHaye.
Right.
When you look into the left, when you look at the Left Behind series, you basically what he contends in a fictional format is that a nuclear holocaust must precede the second coming of Jesus Christ. And you know, a lot of critics have said, Bill Cloud, I believe, is one of the critics that we quote in the new article. You know, is that his books mirror the sum of all fears. You know, except it takes it one step higher because there's just.
Doesn't he say? He says that you couldn't fill a chapter of a Tim LaHaye novel with what's in a Tom Clancy novel.
He outdoes Clancy. With the nuclear anxiety and takes it to a whole new level. And basically, what a nuclear holocaust has become for Tim LaHaye and for other dominionists is basically a reconceptualization of judgment, of God's wrath. It becomes this kind of immanent judgment. It becomes a neo-Gnostic kind of turning on its head.
Neo-Gnostic apocalypse. And again, because the power of the superweapon was created and harnessed by the hand of man, and it constitutes for LaHaye and for several dominionists a necessary precursor to the parousia, to the second coming of Christ, then you have a return again to an anthropocentric soteriology. Salvation is facilitated not by God, not by Jesus Christ, but facilitated through the activism of man himself.
A repudiation of Paul's letter to Ephesians, where he says, "For it is by faith you are saved through grace. Through faith you are saved by grace, not by works." It is the works that kind of defines the whole salvation experience and the creation of the world to come. The apotheosis may look a little different for the dominionist than for the full-fledged Gnostic or New Ager.
Absolutely.
But the process is the same in that it takes the work off of God's shoulders and puts it on ours.
The logical outworkings of their own theology have to invariably lead to apotheosis. It has to lead to an anthropocentric soteriology. Not surprisingly, John Hagee, you know, recently authored a book where he rejects the role of Jesus as Messiah and instead portrays Jesus as a political insurrectionist. If I may draw just one more connection here, though, at this nuclear nexus, if you will, the earliest scribe of scientific romances that created the subgenre of nuclear anxiety fiction, Paul mentioned earlier, it was H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells was, of course, a member of the Coefficients Club, which harbored this overwhelming preoccupation with war, so much so that it even disturbed the atheist philosopher and population control advocate Bertrand Russell, who left after he found members in the organization promoting Entente. But what's interesting is that another member of the Coefficients Club was a gentleman by the name of Halfred Mackinder. Alfred Mackinder was a geographer, and he developed the concept of the Earth Island. He was a Russophobe, and
he believed that divinely ordained destiny of Britain to conquer the world and its tradition of mystical imperialism was imperiled by the Russians, because the Russians occupied what he called the World Island. And the World Island, basically that concept held that Russia, given its geographic karma, was positioned at the center of the Eurasian landmass.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's kind of hard for Britain to get at with their navy.
That makes it virtually impregnable, and
because Britain was something of a formidable naval power. But how do you, how do you touch something that's in the middle of the continent?
You can't sail to Kazakhstan.
Right.
Exactly.
and moreover, Russia had had access to just an almost inexhaustible. Inexhaustible repository of natural resources.
Yes, and being at the heart of the continent, they could, through railways, they could get at any number of resources in a variety of different countries.
Right. Thus making it a veritable autarky, almost virtually independent and self-sufficient, and its ambitions, its imperialist ambitions, he believed would undercut the imperialist ambitions of the British Empire. But at any rate, Mackinder's ideas would influence none other than Karl Haushofer, who was very much influential in Germany and the concept of Lebensborn, and American Cold Warrior James Burnham, who factors in heavily in the genesis of the neoconservative movement. And the neoconservative movement is very closely aligned with the Dominionists, and amongst the Dominionists, you will find this Russophobia that was very much prevalent with thinkers such as Mackinder. In fact, so much so that I believe some postmillennial so-called Christian fiction has even portrayed the Antichrist as being a Russian.
That's not to undercut some of the legitimate research that has been done by those within the neocon orbit concerning Russian deception and the, basically their role in the great game.
No, mm-hmm. they definitely harbor imperialist ambitions that rival the Western elite's own.
Kenneth Timmerman and Jeff Nyquist have actually done some very deep work, concerning Russia's, quest for hegemony and all. But you have to understand and contextualize this and realize that what they're threatened by, it's not a threat to Western democratic ideas so much as it is they view Russia more so as a competitor with the American
mm-hmm.
empire.
Yeah, and moreover, the problem is that when the Dominionist dichotomizes East and West the way that he or she may, there's this complete and total disregard for the inherent complexity of mankind. No one individual can completely and totally be categorized as entirely good or entirely evil. Obviously, we're amalgams of both.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, we all ate from the tree of the knowledge of what? Good
and
evil.
Right.
But in so doing, they create this Manichaean geopolitics in their own minds, where the forces of the West represent the forces of light, of good, and the forces of the East represent the forces of evil, of darkness. And that Manichaean geopolitics is very dangerous, because it, like the Manichaeanism of the dialectic as it was conceived by Karl Marx,
where you had the proletariat against the bourgeoisie. There was no hope for either side through diplomacy, through peaceful discussions to discover an excluded middle and come to an agreement. There was a migration towards a Hegelian synthesis, which would basically amalgamate the worst features of both polar extremes, but there was never ever a solution to the problem. Likewise, when dominionists dichotomize East and West the way they do, there's never ever room for a peaceful solution, and thus you have this continual oscillation between an arms race, technological escalation, and then an easing of tensions and a gradual migration between East and West towards a synthesis. And you can see where this really helps the globalists, who are essentially Hegelian activists, in realizing the dialectical convergence of the two.
One of the points you make in your article, Their Kingdom Come, is that both extremes of Christian political activity, ranging from the dominionist extreme, we need to conquer the world for Jesus Christ, to the abdication theologist, meaning we should stay away from the king from politics. That's earthly, the earthly kingdom, and Jesus said his kingdom is not of this world, so we should just avoid politics altogether. Is that both of those extremes lead to a single end, the same end, which is totalitarianism? And Rick Joyner, who is a very prominent amongst the Joel's Army crowd, considered by many evangelicals, I think, to be fringe. However, his influence is wider than most Christians in America give him credit for, I think. He's a good friend of Lou Engel. He's on the advisory board for The Call. And the Call in Washington, D.C. last year was visited by Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council and Mike Huckabee, former governor of Arkansas and candidate for the United States presidency. And Joyner has said flat out that the kingdom of God, and I am quoting now from a post made to the Elijah list, which is where a lot of these dominionist prophets, and I use that word in air quotes, go to post the word of God, again in air quotes. Joyner wrote, "The kingdom of God will not be socialism, but a freedom even greater than anyone on earth knows at this time." Okay, so far so good. That's true.
Right.
Quoting again, "At first, it may seem like totalitarianism, as the Lord will destroy the Antichrist spirit now dominating the world, with the sword of his mouth, and will shatter many nations like pottery." Skipping down, "Instead of taking away liberties and becoming more domineering, the kingdom will move from a point of necessary control, while people are learning truth, integrity, honor, and how to make decisions, to increasing liberty so that they can."
Oh, my
end
God.
Quote. This is flat from the mouth of a dominionist, prominent, fundamentalist Christian.
How is that any different than when Marx said
exactly
that we were supposed to head towards the enshrinement, the apotheosis of the state would eventually segue into stateless socialism?
Mm-hmm.
It never happened.
Right.
And the Marxist theoreticians, eventually many of them became disillusioned because they could never pinpoint the indeterminate instance in history where the withering away of the state would occur.
And the anarchist actually felt betrayed by the communist at a certain point, because their stateless world, their lawless world, never came into existence.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting that Marx never pointed out the point. Where is this? It always stayed indeterminate. Where is this place where it finally happens? Where all of this statism gives way to a free society? And I noticed that with Joyner, he doesn't give us a point. So you're basically set up for a perpetual theocratic dictatorship.
Yep.
Right there.
But this returns to my original point, that while the political left has identified dominionism as a definite threat. What the political left is unwilling to acknowledge is dominionism's origins with its very own radical ideologues. With the older sociopolitical utopian movements,
so
you had secular movements that sociologically behaved like religions. With dominionism, you have a bit of an inversion of that formula. You have a religious movement that sociologically behaves like a secular one.
and if when you step back and look at the scope of history, you find that the fundamentalists are behaving a lot more like the Roman Catholic Church than they would ever admit.
Well, it's very interesting because you have this ambition for empire, this lust for power. I mean, that's one of the overwhelming preoccupations with the family, and of course Jeffrey Charlotte has talked about this. It's preoccupation with power, mm-hmm. and it rips the notion of the concept of spiritual power as imbued through Christ Jesus from its biblical matrix, from the matrix of the greater biblical gestalt, and makes it more ambiguous, makes it more esoteric. It almost assumes all the trappings of Nietzsche's will to power. And again, here we have these intimations of earlier anti-Christian theoreticians that seems to pervade dominionist thinking.
Well, the best way to destroy the faith is from within, and clearly the enemy has been at work inside the flock from the very beginning, because we see the apostles in the epistles writing against this very doctrine. In fact, Sharon speculated once, and we're not getting doctrinal about this, but it's interesting to postulate. In one of your articles, you wrote about philosopher of Masonic history, I believe, and forgive me for not remembering his name or the article, and I believe it was you guys who cited him, but anyway, who talked about Freemasonry as being the, what was the phrase he used? The occult, is something to do with the builders, basically, the occult pathway of the builders, or some phrase, and I'm sorry I didn't highlight
it. Architects or...
Something like that. Essentially, the history of Freemasonry and the philosophy, the theology of Freemasonry, being the occult distillation of the builders. And as you remember in Scripture, Jesus described himself as the stone that the builders rejected.
Exactly.
And wondering, if there was a connection there. But again, that's kind of interesting speculation and nothing more. The threat, though, again, is to the church and to believers who are deceived into following these heretical doctrines down a path that I believe ultimately leads to the return of the Antichrist, which is ironic and certainly a cosmic joke that will please the enemy to no end, to see how many well-meaning Christians facilitate the return of the Antichrist through their political activity in wanting to do good or to perhaps conquer the planet for Jesus Christ. How does the average Christian discern this dominionist strain inside the body of Christ?
Well, you got to pinpoint this fixation with worldly power,
right?
And this obsession with gaining political capital, among evangelical leaders, and you just want to stray away from churches that basically display those sinister elements. It's going to get a lot harder as time goes on, and I'll tell you why. As the world continues to spin off deeper and deeper into greater and greater chaos, I mean we're now at a point with the economic system where it looks like we could have a W-shaped crisis instead of a V-shaped crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And all. So in other words, we're making the climb. The roller coaster is going up to get ready to slide back down very, you know, very quickly.
I agree.
So, you know, as this chaos grows greater and greater and greater, political messianism is going to become greater and greater and greater. It's going to become more pronounced among the secular crowd, as we saw with Obama and with, you know, just the Jesus mystique that he took on,
mm-hmm.
and with the Dominionist crowd. And we kind of see it with, unfortunately, Ron Paul, where a lot of Dominionists are backing Ron Paul's play and basically see him and see his movement as the cure to all ills. Interestingly
mm-hmm.
enough, CMP participant Richard Viguerie put together a website dedicated to Ron Paul. It was called the Ultimate Ron Paul website. and you know, the problem with that is that it's drawing Ron Paul and drawing patriots into the very deep political world that they supposedly reject, because Richard Viguerie's 77 Leesburg Pike became the home of the private CIA, the network that was set up by Edwin Wilson. Kleins actually moved Eatsco to that location, and they were tenants of Richard Viguerie. So, you know, we're actually being drawn into the camp of the very people that we believe ourselves to be fighting with. Not that all too different from the 60s counterculture that believed themselves to be fighting the establishment, when all along they were destroying the establishment's true enemy, which was the middle class here in the United States.
Right. And if I may also add an answer to your question, Derek, one thing that I would recommend that every Christian does, or that every Christian should do, is familiarize themselves with their soteriology to understand the doctrine of salvation, because I believe that is the core commonality, the core dialectical commonality, or if not the core, one of the most prominent dialectical commonalities shared by the Dominionist and secular progressives, is an anthropocentric soteriology. Again, our soteriology is a theocentric soteriology. We believe that salvation comes from God. The Dominionist, like the secular progressive, like the Marxist, like the communist, like the fascist, like the Comtean positivist, believes that salvation does not originate with a divine being, and this harkens back to Gnosticism, but it comes from within. It comes from action premised upon some form of gnosis. For the sociopolitical utopian on the left, that gnosis is the secret knowledge on how to harness the forces of nature for a sociopolitical purpose. For the Dominionist, that gnosis is basically a secret knowledge on how to use power and how to obtain power, the same sort of power that Jesus had, but to redirect it towards a salvational pursuit that is completely and totally anchored to the ontological confines of this physical cosmos and has very little or nothing to do with the transcendent. So it's really an identifying soteriology. If it's an anthropocentric soteriology, then good chances are that the movement or the church that you have become involved with has very little or nothing to do with with Jesus Christ, with God. Instead, it's merely a sociopolitical utopian movement with a marginally theistic gloss.
Right, and right. When George Barna is reporting that more than half of the pastors being turned out by our Bible colleges and seminaries today don't literally believe in the biblical worldview, you know, the literal death and resurrection of Jesus Christ as an atoning sacrifice for our sins, and so forth, and all that follows from that, you know, the virgin birth and all of the contents of the Bible. More than half the pastors coming out of seminary today don't believe that. It's not too hard to see why most of the people in the pews are willing to go along with a man-centered solution.
It certainly makes it more appealing.
Yeah, to the spiritual problems that face us as a nation. Paul Collins and Philip Collins are the co-authors of The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship. They're also the author and editor of The Hidden Face of Terrorism. And again, a wealth of articles, all researched and heavily footnoted, collected at the Conspiracy Archive, including the one that's formed the focus of our talk tonight, Their Kingdom Come, Dominionism's Quest for Political Capital in the Emergent World Order. We'll put a link to that and, of course, the archive of their articles in the show notes at PIDradio.com. And, guys, you got me intrigued about your next article and about your forthcoming book project, and I want to talk about those as soon as they're ready.
Absolutely, sure.
And that new article called Blackmailed by the Bomb, Nuclear Anxiety and the Cult of the Superweapon is now online at the Illuminati Conspiracy Archive. And we will discuss that with Paul and Philip Collins in two weeks on A View from the Bunker. Their book project, by the way, called Invoking the Beyond. And we look for that hopefully sometime within the next year. And these two guys obviously have more energy than I do because they've also begun a new podcast, which is called The Collins Brothers Unleashed, appropriately enough. And I'll put a link to that and, of course, the articles in the show notes at PIDradio.com. Next week, we'll talk to Dr. Patrick Heron. Patty Heron, our old friend, has a new book out called The Return of the Antichrist. It's an e-book, The Return of the Antichrist and the New World Order. And we'll discuss that on View from the Bunker next Sunday evening. If you'd like to get in contact with us, you can reach us a couple of ways, either by phone or by email. The telephone is a 24/7. It's a Skype line, goes directly to voicemail. And again, open 24/7. The number is country code 1-317-489-9350. That's 1-317-489-9350. And you'll find the link at PIDradio.com. Also, you can send us email to radio@peeringintodarkness.com. That's radio@peeringintodarkness.com. And we appreciate your comments, questions, and suggestions for guests for View from the Bunker. You'll also find the link to Sam the Dachshund's Facebook page there. He has now got more fans than PID Radio, but that is, as he says, just appropriate. So until next time, thank you for listening. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.